food is essential to not just our everyday nourishment, but health in all ways, and is a very big expression of caring for people.
At Home with Growing Older is a nonprofit organization which believes in peer learning and creating discussions which bring the lens of aging to a variety of topics. At Home with Growing Older is proud to be your host of At Home on Air, a radio hour offering connection, community, and knowledge to our participants remotely. Now, we invite you to listen and learn from this live recorded episode of At Home on Air.
Welcome and thank you for joining us. I am Susie Stadler, an architect by profession and the executive director of At Home with Growing Older. I'm also the producer of this program, At Home on Air. For us, the meaning of being at home is twofold. First, it refers to how we can live and how we can thrive in our home environments. And second, how we can come to feel at home with growing older in our wider communities and within ourselves. Dr. Linda Xu, a physician and professionally trained chef, is our guest in this episode. Howard Thornton, an At Home with Growing Older board member and architect, is the host of this episode, At Home in the Kitchen, a Spice Box for Healthy Aging. Welcome to you both, Dr. Xu and Howard Thornton.
Thank you, Susie. I would like to introduce our guest, Dr. Linda Xu. Dr. Xu, MD, chef, diplomat, American Board of Lifestyle Medicine, is a physician, double boarded in internal medicine and lifestyle medicine, a professionally trained chef, and the director of culinary medicine and lifestyle medicine at Kaiser Permanente San Francisco, where she founded Thrive Kitchen, a teaching kitchen for patients. And she is now offering fee-based individual consultations in lifestyle and culinary medicine available to any adult in California. Her first cookbook, Spice Box Kitchen, was a 2022 Gold Award winner in the Nautilus Book Awards and a finalist in the 2022 International Association of Culinary Professionals Awards. Dr. Xu is an associate clinical professor of medicine at the Kaiser Permanente School of Medicine, where she co-founded a culinary medicine elective for medical students. She serves on the boards of the San Francisco Marin Food Bank, Meals on Wheels of San Francisco, and the Teaching Kitchen Collaborative. She is a graduate of Brown University, San Francisco Cooking School, University of California, San Francisco, and The Kitchen, a Michelin-starred restaurant, Murad, in San Francisco. And she has a certificate in plant-based nutrition from Cornell University. Welcome, Dr. Xu.
Thank you so much, Susie and Howard, for having me.
In presenting your background, I just wanted to acknowledge the amount of work that you've done, you know, the amount of education and teaching and writing. And I really appreciate that you're bringing this to us in such a way that's very easy to understand and really gives the agency back to us to prepare our own food and give that as a gift to ourselves and take care of ourselves. So thank you for being here.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
I've read where you talk about the light bulb moment, and it's when you were at the Healthy Kitchen, Healthy Lives conference that was sponsored by Harvard School of Public Health and the Culinary Institute of America. And you were, as a physician, were attending this conference, and you had this light bulb moment where you decided you wanted to become a chef and teach your patients how to cook. So I just would love for you to talk about that and what that was like and how you made that happen.
Yeah, I love telling this story because as many of the listeners of this conversation with even more life experience than I have will realize, as you move on in life, you get a different perspective. Just to kind of backtrack with that, I'm very type A. I'm very organized. I'm a planner. You know, I do things. But I actually couldn't have planned this career. I think that's really important. And I think that light bulb moment was the first time I really actually took a little bit of a gamble to follow my passion, which then followed with a lot of type A organizing and getting additional education. But it was because I realized in that moment, again, something unplanned, that this was the most helpful thing I could do, both for my patients and for my own enjoyment of my own career. So at that point, I had been practicing as a primary care doctor for a little over a decade, and it was getting a little bit, you know, honestly, routine for me. Not that I didn't love seeing all my individual patients and they were all different, but the day-to-day felt like I was just writing a lot of prescriptions, and I didn't feel very satisfied because I felt like I wasn't really doing individualized care and I wasn't making my patients feel better. You know, I was writing a lot of prescriptions for blood pressure medicines, for cholesterol medicines, and diabetes medications, which are still necessary in many cases. But I had never been trained in what can the patient do for themselves that will not only help them with their condition or even prevent or sometimes reverse certain conditions, but actually feel better. Pills don't make people feel better. At this conference, since it was focusing both on nutrition science and culinary science, teaching people how to cook with the amazing chefs at the Culinary Institute of America, it tied into my lifelong love of, honestly, eating. Eating and cooking. I took my first cooking class when I was 7 years old, never thought about doing cooking professionally. And then suddenly it was there in front of me like, oh, this is what I can do. So I did it and just jumped in without looking back. And less than a week after that conference, I taught my first cooking class to patients.
How did you end up starting the Thrive Kitchen?
There was a little bit of, you know, trial and error in trying to figure out how to get this done. I really had to learn how to teach people how to cook. Just like with any other skill, you can do something very well yourself, but learning how to teach it well to people can be a completely different thing. So I did a lot of teaching classes to the community in a variety of settings, like community centers, libraries, et cetera, on my own time to really learn and feel comfortable with teaching people and also in writing healthy recipes, you know, sometimes creating new ones, sometimes adapting existing recipes. After about 3 years of that, I approached my leadership where I used to work saying, hey, you know, I've been volunteering to do this for 3 years now. Can you support me? And it didn't happen. We'll just leave it at that. But like with many other things in life, I kind of looked around and I thought, okay, I know my idea has to happen. I'm just so driven by the passion for this because I know it really helps people. There's got to be another place. And so at that time, Kaiser Permanente, where I've been working now for the last 7.5 years, had this very large ad campaign, which anyone in California would have seen, the Thrive campaign. Billboards, radio, TV, everywhere. And I knew that Kaiser had the first farmers markets at medical centers. You know, this is a very long time ago. My thinking was very simple. Okay, people can get their produce there. Do they know what to do with it? Literally as simple as that. And I have realized with all the wonderful education I've had, the simplest concepts are actually the best ones. That was my first simplest concept. Let me figure out if I can convince the people who brought farmers markets to the medical centers of my idea. And so that's what I did. I pitched it and they said, okay, we'll give you a shot.
Oh, that's wonderful. Thank you. You know, one of the things that you've talked about too is produce prescriptions in culinary medicine. Can you talk about that?
Yes. So this is another area that's related to this idea of culinary medicine, which is using the art of food and cooking combined with the science of medicine and nutrition. The produce prescription goes a step further and actually prescribes and provides produce, as it sounds like, for people who need it for whatever their medical condition is. We currently are doing some studies on these programs to consider at Kaiser Permanente. They do exist in some other medical systems. It's an area that has been around in various places for more than 10 years now. It really just takes things a step further. Like, not only will we tell you what will be best for you to eat for your health, but we can actually provide it for you. And typically it's for somebody who is low income and cannot purchase those things themselves. It's done in many different ways, often with the assistance of food banks. And so it ties into my volunteer board work at the food bank that I serve at as well. It's very full circle in the concept of how do we take care of a person? Food is essential to not just our everyday nourishment, but health in all ways, and is a very big expression of caring for people. So I love that idea, and I'd love to see where that can go in the future.
Yes. One thing I appreciate is the way you introduce making culturally adaptable recipes. And I think that really is evident in your book, Spice Box Kitchen, the way you have it organized. And of course, it features the masala dhaba Wen's personal spice box. Could you talk about what masala dabba means for you and how one starts that?
Yeah, so you can think of the masala dabba as the actual literal item, which is used in India and is a large metal circular container that has smaller little containers inside in which you put your spices that you use most often. And so they're at the ready, they're available to you. But you can think of it figuratively as well. Like your spice box is your spice cabinet. I also like to think of it as the equivalent of a doctor's bag and the medical instruments in those. No one actually has one of those bags anymore. But the idea that spices are tools, they're tools for flavor so that you can have more delicious food that you enjoy eating. Spices were our first medicine. They're all anti-inflammatory. We've known now for a decade or more that all chronic disease is actually related to chronic inflammation. So by having the spice box, it works in both directions for culinary medicine, which is why I love it. I've been labeling all of my things spice box in some way. I just like that concept that we have our spices at the ready at all times and that they're personalized to us.
Yes, I like that too. We talk about having our toolkit in our Aging 360 program. Having these tools at your ready makes so much sense. You also promote recipes that are plant predominant. Can you talk about that and the proportions of food on your plate?
Sure. We have a growing number of nutrition studies, but they're still lacking compared to some other types of medical and scientific research. The diet types, meaning the eating patterns that we have the most evidence for currently, are the Mediterranean diet, which was studied in Greece, Spain, and in other parts of the Mediterranean. There's also the various vegetarian or plant-based diets. One of the largest studies for that was the Adventist II Health Study, which studied like 60 or 70,000 adults over 4 or 5 years and found really a very interesting inversely linear relationship between body mass index, which is an imperfect measurement, but the best that we have right now of basically if someone is underweight, normal weight, medically speaking, overweight or obese. So an inverse relationship between body weight and risk of type 2 diabetes. It's like completely matched in an inverse relationship. But what I like to point out from this is that they studied various types of diets along the continuum from the standard American diet all the way to completely plant-based or vegan diet. Along this pretty much straight curve, as you get more plant-based, the lower your risk is of both having excess body weight and type 2 diabetes. The takeaway from that is the better that you can do, the more plants that you can have, you do not have to be 100% plant-based, the lower risk you'll have of type 2 diabetes. Other studies have also shown that correlation to lower risk of heart disease and other risk factors for heart disease. So diabetes is a big one. High blood pressure, high cholesterol are some others. We know that plants help with preventing both of those as well. Plants also have antioxidants, which fight inflammation, which I mentioned already as a cause of chronic disease. These are also important in preventing cancers. Basically, as you move in the direction of eating more plants, you get all of those benefits as well as prolonged longevity. There's only really good things to say about it. I really like to leave this very flexible for the individual, again, for one's own tastes, preferences, how people feel as an individual on different eating patterns, just as I do with the type of diet. I really firmly believe that there isn't one healthy diet and all cultures have a healthy diet. And that really has not been promoted very much until recently. We really kind of talked about the Mediterranean diet with Mediterranean and other Western foods. And that leaves a lot of people in our very diverse population feeling like, I don't have the right foods to eat. My culture doesn't have the right foods. That's a very harmful message and very counterproductive. With both of these things, I want people to think about eating what you like and what feels best for you, but try to eat more plants. That's really the best thing that anyone can do.
And what about sources of protein? I know that as I'm moving into more plant-based diets, I'm becoming more aware of where I get my protein. And I know that you've talked a lot about that in your book.
Yes. So all foods have protein, including all plants. However, the density of protein is lower in plants, except for, you know, beans and legumes. Those are going to be your best plant-based sources of protein. And also, as we age, we do have increased protein requirements. So I don't want to minimize the importance of this. I actually think it would be useful for most people as they're getting older to calculate how much protein they're getting in their diet and to ask their doctor or nutritionist how much they think they need for their particular medical issues, because if you have certain medical conditions, you will need even more. Even a generally healthy older adult will need about 50% to 100% more protein, depending on who you ask, than a younger adult. Not having enough protein will interfere with most health processes, but importantly, lead to what's known as sarcopenia, or a loss of muscle mass. And that is linked to a lot of health problems, because then you can't be mobile, you're at risk of falling, all of those things. So protein is very important. I would say that most people are over concerned with protein when they're younger and healthy, and that's not necessary. But when you're older with certain health conditions, that's the time to think about protein. In terms of non-meat sources of protein, you're going to get the most protein, again, out of meat. So the reference index would be 3 ounces of beef. That has 24 grams of protein. So I wanted to share with you three other sources that come pretty close to that. The first is Greek yogurt. A cup of Greek yogurt, which is dairy, of course, has the same amount, 24 grams of protein, as 3 ounces of beef. That's very astounding, actually. Because we know that red meat, of all the animal-based foods, is correlated to the most negative health consequences, with other things like poultry and fish and seafood being better. Dairy is also better for you than having red meat. So that's huge, actually, just a cup. For many people, as we're getting older, people's appetites can go down, and it can be hard to actually get in enough food, a large quantity of food. And so I think going for protein-dense sources like that is a really good idea. Salmon also has about the same amount of protein as beef, and that is much better for you health-wise. In fact, has many health benefits for heart disease. If you look at that study that I referenced, the Adventist II health study, the pescatarian diet, meaning vegetables plus seafood, falls right in the middle of that risk for both overweight and also type 2 diabetes risk. So I think of the pescatarian diet as being kind of a good compromise for a lot of people. And then finally, peanuts come pretty close. Of all completely plant-based sources, peanuts are pretty close to that amount of protein. So I would look at those three. And then behind those are all the things like beans and legumes. Those have just slightly less protein. So as an example, a cup of lentils has 17 grams versus the 3 ounces of beef having 24 grams. A cup of chickpeas and black beans have 15 grams of protein. So really pretty good. And then if you look at things like tempeh and tofu, soybean-based sources of protein that are from Asia, a small amount of those, a half a cup actually has, for tempeh, almost 16 grams of protein, and for tofu, 10 grams of protein. So if you actually had a cup of either of those, which I don't think is too much to eat, you will actually be getting more protein than your 3 ounces of steak. So I would say look for legumes, think about tofu and tempeh, think about salmon and Greek yogurt if you're not eating completely plant-based.
That is great to hear. The other thing is using spices with cooking is a way to counter that as we age, our taste buds dull. People tend to use more salt, but spices is a way to be able to avoid using more salt.
For sure. And it makes it more interesting, honestly. Some people feel like, okay, I have to eat this healthy diet now. I'm stuck with, you know, steamed broccoli and this broiled fish, and that's boring. It's not boring, and it's not the same dinner from one night to another if you vary the spices. I really do think that spices are fun, and they really do, you know, conjure a connection to places that we either have been or would like to go to, a cuisine that we don't know or that we want to explore. There are enough spices, enough combinations of spices that it's pretty infinite in terms of what you can produce. And it really will completely, in a very simple way, transform something from dull to kind of interesting and exciting that has a story.
Yes, I've been experimenting more with spices just in terms of eating some of the same foods like tofu. It's nice to be able to travel to different countries with the spices and have a different experience in my meal.
That's great. I love to hear that.
Could you talk about sort of what your core message is? One of them was, you know, eating home-cooked food.
For many reasons, eating home-cooked is the best way to take care of ourselves, not just in the sense of this is better for your health, which it is, because you have control over your ingredients. It will always have less sodium and fat and added sugar than food that's prepared outside. But it's also a form of self-care and kind of an expression of individuality. Whether you're cooking for yourself or for other people, you can tailor that meal. I think there's a lot that's very enjoyable and, again, an expression of care about cooking at home. But even if you don't care about any of that, it is better for your health. So that's one of the main messages. Cook more at home. It's also a way of sticking within a fixed budget, which a lot of us will be when we're older. And then it will keep your skills up both mentally and physically. You need to do a lot of things to cook, right? First of all, you need to exercise executive functioning to be able to plan your grocery list, to plan your meals. You need to be able to continue reading things, to try out new recipes, to follow instructions. And then physically, it's exercise. You have to stand for part of it. You have to use your arms for it. You need to use all of your senses. So I actually really think of it as good mental and physical exercise as well. So many reasons to cook at home.
And the other part is we eat with our eyes. So even when we're a solo diner, about plating our meal.
Yeah. So I will always tell someone within the first few minutes of meeting them that I worked in a Michelin-starred restaurant, because that was, you know, dream come true. But a lot of what one does in a Michelin-starred restaurant is plate the food beautifully, because that's part of what people are paying for. Like, the meal should look fabulous and spectacular. But you can and you should do the same thing for yourself at home. I like to say that we eat with our eyes first. That really contributes to satiety in terms of not just feeling physically full, but feeling satisfied by a meal. If it starts out looking beautiful, you will enjoy it more. You know, it's a form of pleasure also. And it doesn't have to be fancy food. You just plate it and garnish it with some herbs. Herbs also have a lot of antioxidants, vitamins, and minerals, and count towards our servings of vegetables and add flavor as well. So use herbs, put it on a nice plate. Even if it's leftovers or if it's takeout, it will look much better, right? If you take it out of whatever container and plate it nicely. And I think this is especially important if you're cooking or eating by yourself. Like, don't make the mistake that it doesn't matter because it's just you. Who's the most important person? It's yourself. I really think it's important to plate your food. It doesn't take much time and it can be kind of fun. I love doing it.
Yes, I just want to say that plating your food has also worked for us when we were working with our Aging 360 workshop in SROs in San Francisco, where we have given people lovely, colorful trays and people put a pre-cooked meal on it and it just looks much better.
Much better, yes.
Yes.
And even lighting a candle.
Oh, yeah. And some nice music. Why not, right?
Right.
You are listening to At Home On Air. We are now switching to questions by participating audience members in this recorded live episode. If you want a chance to ask your question, visit us at athomewithgrowingolder.org and register for the next live episode.
So Linda asks, how do you feel about vegetable juicing without the fiber?
When you use a juicer, you get all the nutrients, but you don't get the fiber, right? So unless someone has problems digesting fiber, which some people do, I think that it's better to blend things in a blender because you get the fiber that way still, or take some of the pulp, maybe not all of it, because it kind of defeats the purpose if you're putting it all back in and adding it back to the juice. Fiber is really important. People don't get enough fiber at any age in our modern life. And so I think it's better. However, if that's just one juice per day, and the rest of the time you are eating fruits and vegetables, I mean, that's fine. If it helps people get more vitamins, but it's not quite as good as the intact vegetable.
Thank you. Candice says, I love spicy in any ethnic cooking, jalapenos, sriracha, tapatio, hot curry. But I have a question. With high blood pressure, is this a good idea?
As far as I know, there have not been any studies that show any risk of having spicy things for high blood pressure. In fact, there have been some studies that have shown a correlation, not with a really good mechanism, between eating spicy foods and one, burning more calories, and two, in prolonged life, longevity. So go for it, as long as you like it.
I'm sure she likes this answer. Gina asks, sugar is known to be problematic. What spices would you offer as substitutes that satisfy but don't have health and well-being downsides?
Thank you, Gina, for that question, because I usually do like to talk about this. So there are a lot of spices that can be used in both sweet, i.e. desserts, and savory cooking, often in curries, that are actually naturally very sweet tasting. So cinnamon is probably the one that people think about the most, which can lower both blood pressure and blood sugar. And I actually think tastes sweeter than sugar. So often, if you don't want to add sugar, cinnamon is the way to go, just for that pure sweetness. Other spices that I think are nice, cardamom is actually my favorite spice, but that's a good one that can be used in both sweet and savory applications. It's not as sweet as cinnamon. And then all the baking spices, you can think about those, like pumpkin pie spice that blend has cinnamon and other things in them, like clove and nutmeg. Think of those things and just try. Importantly, when you're trying to change how you're eating and cooking, know that it will take a little bit of time, but not that long for your palate to change and adjust. About 4 weeks for most people, sometimes sooner, sometimes a little bit longer. In the beginning, you'll think, oh, this is not sweet enough. But after that time, if you stop adding sugar will taste way too sweet. That's a great question because there are benefits in all those spices and none of the downsides.
Thank you. Rachel asks, taking high cholesterol into account, what's the best kind of Greek yogurt, fat-free or low-fat? Yeah. A related comment from Delia is, I have read that low-fat yogurt is not better for you because sugar is used to replace the flavor lost in removal of fat.
Yes, thank you. Well, you kind of answered the question. So I think low-fat, you should read the label though, because every manufacturer makes things differently. We do know that whole fat dairy has saturated fat, and that is problematic if you have high cholesterol. It often is this balance. Again, it's in how they manufacture it. Some brands will not have as much added sugar, but many of them will, especially if it's completely fat-free. So low fat is often kind of a good in-between there. The thing with talking about these foods, though, is nothing is really perfect, right? So if you're eating the Greek yogurt to get the protein, you might have to accept that that is where your fat is coming from that day out of your meals. And think about what you're going to counterbalance that with. Lots of fresh fruit, berries, especially flaxseed, other things that might help with your cholesterol. Never think of one food and analyze that and think, okay, this is either perfectly good or perfectly bad for me. Everything is in the context of everything else that we eat. A lot of people will ask about carbohydrates, carbs like bread and pasta, especially if it's refined white bread or white pasta. We know that you can actually moderate the effects of that, which would normally on its own lead to a rapid increase in your blood sugar. If you combine it with other things, a source of protein, a source of fiber, a source of fat. So I think that's a very good example of how we don't eat things usually in isolation and you can balance certain things and just to not get too hung up on it, but just kind of balance where, you know, if you have one thing that you think isn't great for your health condition that you're eating one time a day, have more vegetables the rest of the day.
Crystal asks, are you familiar with Dr. William Lee's book, Eat to Beat Disease? Would that book complement the information in your book?
Yes, I've definitely heard about it. I haven't actually read it, but I know about it. And I think they're quite different. Mine is a cookbook. The first 50 pages of it are actually what I like to call nutrition light, but it's really more a guide to cooking and a glossary of all the spices and their health benefits and of all the produce that I use in the book and their particular health benefits. Whereas his book, as far as I know, is much more about the science. I intentionally wanted this to be a cookbook that could be used by people who wanted to get a health-focused cookbook or just someone who wanted to have interesting and really delicious recipes using spices from around the world. So I think, yes, they would be complementary.
Can I just intercept really quickly and ask you, what is your favorite recipe in your own cookbook?
Oh, no, that is one that I can't answer. So let me think. For the listeners, it has four sections of recipes divided geographically. The first is California slash some Mexican recipes there, because California was part of Mexico. And then Asia, and then the Mediterranean, Middle East, and then Trinidad in the Caribbean. So kind of wide parts of the world, all of which use spices and all of whom have recipes which can be made very much plant-based. So I probably can name a favorite recipe from each section. Let me try to cheat that way. If I can even think about that. Now, as I said that, it's hard to pick. I think one of the popular recipes from the California section is pozole verde, which is a meat version of that famous Mexican soup. It has so many delicious things in it. Hominy is the main ingredient in pozole. It also has a lot of different vegetables and herbs in it. And I like that recipe also because it actually saved my elderly neighbor's life indirectly. He was a widower. And so when I was writing my cookbook and testing a lot of recipes, I would give him all my food. And I knew he was actually fairly food insecure at that time. Not that he couldn't afford food, but that he didn't cook. And I remember that night, I was actually sick when I was cooking that. So I had some of my family bring it over and they came back and they said, he didn't look too good. And so I was like, what do you mean? You know, he just looked pale. He lived by himself. And so that was my clue that I needed to check in on him. And when he didn't answer, after half an hour, then an hour, then, you know, I called his son. He ended up needing emergency surgery. that sort of took a different turn, but that recipe, he never ate it because he was in the hospital. But if I had not sent over that recipe, he actually would have died. It's another example of how like food can link you to people in many different ways. Mm-hmm. Beyond that, that recipe is just really delicious. So that's my favorite from that section. From the Asia section, I mean, there's so many. My family is from Taiwan, and so Asian food is probably my favorite cuisine overall. But I think one of the more fun recipes in that section is what I call Aloha Pineapple Kimchi. Each geographic section of recipes is also further divided into breakfast, lunch, dinner, sweet things slash desserts, because I do think there is room for desserts in a healthy diet as well. And then the last part is snacks, pantry, and fermented things. I encourage you to fill your own pantry with homemade condiments and things like that, and pickles too. So there's a recipe for kimchi and one that involves adding fresh pineapple to it, which I kind of invented one Thanksgiving in Hawaii when I was cooking for friends. I always try to make things in theme of the place. You know, kimchi is eaten a lot because there are a lot of Asians in Hawaii. The pineapple was an obvious thing. And I thought, oh, this would taste really good together. So that's where that recipe came from. And then from the Mediterranean section, Middle East, again, there's so many that I like. I'll name one. There's this Moroccan eggplant salad called zalouk, and it has cinnamon in it, actually. I like to play with using sweet spices in savory dishes. That salad doesn't typically have cinnamon in it, but I went to Morocco once. It's actually how I celebrated working in the Michelin-starred Moroccan restaurant that I worked in. And at this particular cafe, that was their twist on it. They added cinnamon to it. It was just a very special night when I ate there. And so that was my memory of that. For me, food is very much tied to people, places, experiences. And then finally, in the Trinidadian section, there is a recipe, the jerk tempeh kebabs. That is actually one of my favorites. So many of you may have heard of jerk chicken, typically, which is from Jamaica, not Trinidad. They are rival countries, but it was so good, I had to include a couple of Jamaican recipes. There's a recipe for the jerk marinade, which you can use on any sort of protein. You can use it on tempeh, you can use it on tofu. And I like that because it teaches people who feel like, I don't really know how to enjoy tempeh or tofu. I'm not used to that flavor. You can flavor it with anything. You can either bake it or grill it. It has just such a nice aroma, flavor, and appearance. So that's my favorite from that section. Also because it helps people learn how to eat proteins that they may not be used to eating.
Thank you so much, Dr. Xu. And I realized that talking about food also makes you really hungry.
I picked out recipes that I liked out of the cookbook, but I just wanted to say that, you know, the cookbook is a personal expression by you as well, because those regions are places where you have lived or have connections. I appreciate that part of it and that it's a way to share with us what you love.
Thank you. Yes, I actually had written a lot more sort of autobiographical stuff in there, but they cut out a lot of it because they're like, there are only so many pages in this. And so there would have been more is what I'm saying. Food is personal for me, as I think it should be for everybody. And so I was really happy to be able to write a little bit about my experiences.
Yeah. I would like to bring up another question from Val, who says, any clues about how many grams of sugars per day to stay below and in counting these grams, do natural sugar count or is the tally added sugars?
So it's going to depend on your particular health conditions, especially people with diabetes. There isn't really a one size fits all answer to this, except that I would focus more on added sugars. A lot of people get caught up in, oh, fruit has sugar in it, I can't eat that. That could be true of juices, getting back to the juicing question, because again, you don't have the fiber. And I already mentioned that carbohydrates and their absorption of the blood sugar into your bloodstream is very much affected by what the carbohydrates are in association with. And so a whole intact fruit is actually good for you. And I would not count those sugars. In fact, there have been some studies that show that people who ate more fruit have a lower risk of developing type 2 diabetes than people who do not eat fruit. Mm-hmm. Fruit has a lot of things in it, vitamins, minerals, hydration, antioxidants, and importantly, fiber, certain types of fiber, pectins, which are really helpful with your blood sugar control. So unless you have what medically is called brittle type 1 diabetes, where you're exquisitely sensitive to sugar, in which case you should really be working with a dietitian on what you're eating, I would focus more on added sugars. There are a lot of good charts about how much added sugar is too much for you. The less, the better. Again, it depends on your size, your age, all those things, but really the less, the better. For example, let's just go back to the yogurt. I only buy plain yogurt. That wasn't always the case. But if you look at a cup of any flavored yogurt, it will have a minimum of 16 grams in that tiny cup. It's dessert. I'd rather eat my dessert than have yogurt because that's not really dessert to me. And so having sugar, added sugar, but in the form of berries is a much better way to go about that, for example. For most people, I really advise you to stay below 30 grams of added sugar per day. That is the equivalent of 5 or 6 teaspoons of sugar. It doesn't take much of adding sugar to be above recommendations. So try to adjust. I should mention that. I actually have a sweet tooth. I used to give my neighbor half of my dessert. So, you know, he loved me. I fed him, I gave him cake, all those things. But I really had to kind of change because it just wasn't working for my health as well. As I've been getting older, my palate did change, but I still do love a really good dessert. How I adapt it is I want the real thing, but I split it and I only have it when I go out most of the time. You know, that doesn't mean that I go out every night. So like maybe once a week, I have a really good dessert and then I get to enjoy it. I'm not depriving myself. I'm not looking for sugar all the time because I don't need it. I don't crave it anymore. I really enjoy really good fruits. And so I'm looking forward to the summer and stone fruit season. That is a good way to get your sugar and fiber in. Really good peaches and plums.
That sounds wonderful. Rachel says, can you say a little bit more why people have a hard time digesting fiber? Is this more common with age?
No, it's with certain health conditions like irritable bowel syndrome. Like you'll know if you have trouble with digesting fiber. Usually it would have manifested much earlier. But I would say if you're someone who hasn't typically eaten a lot of fruits and vegetables or whole grains or beans and haven't had that much fiber, anybody will have trouble digesting a huge load of fiber if they're not used to it. So start slowly. Don't go from, you know, only eating steak and potatoes to having a whole head of broccoli as a substitution. You will not digest that well. It takes about 2 weeks for your body, as your microbiome actually changes, to basically be able to digest additional amounts of fiber. It's that quick. So start slowly, increase maybe every other day with a little bit more.
Delia asks, what about the benefits of psyllium for internal body cleansing? Can you advise?
Yeah, so psyllium is a form of insoluble or non-digestible fiber. It's what's in Metamucil. But it actually has been kind of trendy recently. It's apparently been used in India in cooking for health benefits. Now there are all these recipes out there for literally using Metamucil to make bread and things like that. It's basically another source of fiber. It's probably not better or worse than other sources, but it's a very concentrated source that you can add to things.
Rachel says, I know a woman who follows the protocol of an MD for cinnamon capsules for Parkinson's. She swears it's why her Parkinson's hasn't progressed in a decade.
I'm glad that her Parkinson's hasn't progressed, but I haven't actually heard any solid studies about that. I think there might be some suggestions. A lot of these studies are in animal studies and not in humans, but no harm. And, you know, potentially because cinnamon is anti-inflammatory, like all spices, maybe that's the mechanism. Probably not harmful, but I don't think there's solid evidence with that. And on that note with capsules, you do have to be careful with any supplements because they're not FDA regulated. They can often have contaminants, which will get magnified if they're concentrated, which they would be in a capsule, right? That's much more potent than adding a little bit to your food. So I just want to bring that up as something to be aware of. Most of the time, I would recommend having your spices in the form of food. The one exception to that, because you need a fair amount to have benefit, would be for turmeric, which can be used as an anti-inflammatory substitute for things like ibuprofen. Even with that, you still have to be careful because it's very concentrated. But to get the amount of turmeric that you need, or curcumin, which is actually the active ingredient, to have anti-inflammatory benefit for pain, you really do need a capsule for that, combined with black pepper to increase its bioavailability.
I am also just curious, in the very beginning, you talked that you give people food prescriptions, like medicine prescriptions. Is this correct? Can you give an example of such a prescription?
So Howard and I were talking about produce prescriptions, which is slightly different, but I do talk about a food prescription in my new culinary medicine individual consultations, where I'll look at the person's likes, dislikes in terms of food, and then their health conditions. And if there is solid evidence for a certain diet that is therapeutic for that, create a menu around that. It's actually quite complex and takes a lot of time. One example that I really felt proud of creating was for a patient of mine who has had issues with high cholesterol. There is actually a particular diet called a portfolio diet that was studied with particular foods in it that was shown to be very powerful as a starting dose of a statin in lowering LDL cholesterol. I basically provided this patient with a list of recipes that would contain those foods and that were in the cuisine that she enjoyed eating. So that is my most advanced culinary prescription that I give to people. But short of that, the simplest and the first prescriptions that I actually put into practice, literally into my saved messages that I could use in the computer and send out to people as a prescription, were for people who said that they were a salty snacker, the person who's eating chips all the time. I have a recipe for homemade kale chips. And then for people who like ice cream, I have a recipe for banana nice cream, which is just using a frozen banana, maybe a little bit of milk and spices, whatever else you want to put in to make a substitute for that. Those I also consider prescriptions because that small change, you can actually make a pretty big difference. Someone is sitting there watching TV every night, eating either a bowl of ice cream or a bag of chips. Making that one change can make a very big impact on their weight, their blood sugar, their blood pressure, and their overall health. I consider those to be food prescriptions as well.
That's pretty amazing. I was just considering going to my doctor and having this kind of conversation. It would be so pleasurable. I also would feel that my doctor is really looking at my whole self. I think that's really part of it.
Yeah. It's equally pleasurable for me. You know, as I was saying in the beginning, this was also about my finding a way to really feel continued passion for my career is to be able to provide this special kind of help for people.
Question for Mariah is, she's curious how teas with spices like ginger tea or cinnamon tea compare with adding similar spices directly to food in terms of their potency.
I assume it would matter depending on how the tea is prepared. You know, sometimes those may or may not be the full spice and they might have some flavor additives. Something I hadn't thought about, which I learned about when I did a little collaboration with a spice company when I was promoting my book, is you can just make your own tea out of ground spices. For example, ginger tea, which I normally make by boiling fresh ginger in water. You can actually get away by just stirring a teaspoon of ground ginger into hot water. You can do the same thing with cinnamon and, you know, drink it quickly because it'll settle, or just keep restirring it. That is actually a very economical and probably a more potent and adjustable way of having a spiced tea and knowing what's in it. I really think a lot of tea bags, even regular black tea, is not always like the amount of tea or the quality of tea that you'd want. And so I think better to use ground spices. I want all of you to try that.
Yes, I will do this immediately tonight.
One thing I have read that you've said is cooking classes promote dietary change more than just nutrition education. So to me, what I'd like to do is find cooking classes that are in my area that I can attend, because it feels like that is a way to connect and learn from other people too.
Yes. So I encourage anyone who's listening to take my Thrive Kitchen cooking classes. They're all virtual now. So it's not the same as being in person. They're free for Kaiser members, but they're just $20 each class. They're 2-hour classes. And I change the menu every month, which from an educational point of view, it's a lot of work. But I want people to try a lot of different things and enjoy a lot of different vegetables, a lot of different flavors. And so they're open to anyone. So take a class from me. Now, you know what my style is. You know that it will always feature spices. It will be very global. And it's typically something that people have not had before. I just taught one last night on the theme of Asian salads for Asian Pacific American Heritage Month. I made a Burmese rainbow salad, which has a lot of different vegetables and noodles in a tamarind-based dressing with a lot of aromatics. I made a Balinese green apple salad for my cookbook, and I made Taiwanese quick cucumber pickle, which is also from my cookbook, but importantly for my mother. And so I just wanted to show that, you know, a salad is not the same salad that you think you're having, just to give people more ideas. And then I encourage people to, once they learn how to make any of my recipes, to put your own twist on it, right? Individualize it. So Thrive Kitchen cooking classes, but if you just look up Thrive Kitchen, you'll find it.
Thank you, Dr. Hsu. I missed that, and I will definitely come to those. Also, I just want to put in another mention of your cookbook, Spice Box Kitchen. It's available in libraries, it's in bookstores, and then also you can find the book on your Spice Box Travels website.
Thank you. Libraries, if they don't have it, if you ask for it, they will order it, which helps as well. I love to get it into the circulation. Also, it's available on Kindle for those of you who are trying to minimize more things in your house.
Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you all for coming. And thank you so much, Susie and Howard, for having me. It was a pleasure.
It was transformative, really. I mean, I'm thinking about cooking and spices and kitchen organization in a very different way after this conversation. So thank you so much.
We're glad to hear that, and you're very welcome. Bye, everybody.
This episode of At Home On Air was produced by the At Home with Growing Older team. We could not host these conversations without the generosity of our marvelous and passionate guests and hosts. Thank you for sharing your personal and professional insights. Thank you to our live audience for your thoughtful contributions. To subscribe to this podcast and for more information, visit us at homewithgrowingolder.org. Thank you to our sponsors, Rhoda Goldman Plaza, the jewel of San Francisco's assisted living and memory care communities, and the Walnut Foundation, a San Francisco family foundation. At Home with Growing Older strives to educate, inspire, and connect people across generations and disciplines to re-envision and improve the experiences of later life. Don't forget to subscribe and tune in for the next episode.